The Robber Barons, The Rise of Investment Banking, Part 2, The Collapsing Railroads and Their Wars, and J.P. Morgan. The chief objective of the investment banker was to capture the differential between the price arranged to pay for capital and the price which could induce a broad public of savers and investors to pay for it, of course, with the funds of their own. And of course, J.P. Morgan would do this with his own funds that he had accumulated, which is probably between $5 and $10 million. Morgan can buy an option on railroads or industrial capital, giving advances to the needy borrowers, and then in a campaign of some days or weeks in the security exchange or in the money centers, land the capital upon the public, both at home and abroad, by working with a syndicate of investment bankers who shared his commission and, of course, provided more customers of their own. Morgan could then indefinitely extend the scope of his operations. Furthermore, part of the money realized for the railroads or other enterprise being kept on deposit either in his own or in an associated set of banks could be used again and again for the buying and the selling of capital, while the commissions from the turnover grew like a snowball. It is little wonder that Morgan's enthusiasm for big projects mounted. He became a recognized leader in railroad ventures, and each success augmented his prestige among his following of capitalists. Morgan might have thrown himself into investment promotions without restraint or fear of the future if it were not for his banking partner, Mr. Drexel. Morgan was known, according to the financial gossip of his contemporaries, as a plunger, someone who saw something and plunged into it with reckless abandon. Drexel is obviously a much more refined and reserved individual. He always liked to cling grimly, as they say, to his gold. Therefore, on occasion, he was there to bail Morgan out whenever he had overextended himself. But no matter how much Morgan's appetite was whetted for large-scale investment banking, the condition of the railroads after 1873 was a real concern. According to John Moody, by the 1880s, about twice as many railroad lines had been built in the United States than the United States could absolutely profitably employ. By 1876, 40% of all the railroad bonds in the United States were in default. In 1879, there were 65 railroad lines that were capitalized at $234 million that were in default. And between 1873 and 1879, European investors had lost over $600 million through railroad bankruptcies and, of course, old-fashioned fraud. In 1884, a brief period of prosperity took place. Unfortunately, it was brief and shortly returned to being little better than the previous time period. Poor's Manual stated that the entire capital stock of the railroads at that time was about $4 billion. Now, most of that represented watered-down stock, and a large portion of the bonded debt that was issued in this period, 1881 to 1883, was actually in excess of construction, or simply pure hope that was being sold to the public. Yet, unremitting railroad competition continued. By 1884, there were 5 trunk lines that ran between New York and Chicago, with 2 more under construction, when only 3 were absolutely needed. Most of these railroads were in some variation or stock of bankruptcy. The empire builders continued building, but they could only do that so long as stocks and bonds could be sold to the public. Then, in the contest for existing business, they began to fight and destroy each other without mercy. In the East, the Pennsylvania Railroad, contested the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad's entrance into New York. In the West, Hill relentlessly carved into the Northern Pacific's freight territory and pressed Henry Villard into bankruptcy. In the canyons of the Rocky Mountains, railroad gangs waged hand-to-hand fighting for new mining centers. There was cutthroat competition. There were secret rebates. Blackmail took place in the 1880s. In 1883, Cornelius Vanderbilt of the New York Central, peaceful as he was finally goaded into a railroad war of extermination. Vanderbilt then teamed up with Carnegie, and they came up with a plan to free Western Pennsylvania from the clutches of the Pennsylvania Railroad. They would use the Reading Railroad and then build an offshoot line called the Southern Pennsylvania Railroad. Then William Rockefeller and William Whitney created the West Shore Railroad to weaken the Pennsylvania Railroad's hold on the oil area. So we've got the two industrialists, the steel man, the oil man, and railroads trying to get rid of the people in the middle. Well, J.P. Morgan saw the wastefulness of this process and returned from England in June of 1885. He was determined to do something that would bring more harmony among the trunk lines and obviously to put more money in his pocket. He decided he would pressure Cornelius Vanderbilt to induce him to sell out. What the pressure he was going to use is not clear. But at this point, even the richest railroad barons engaged in this war needed to find as much ammunition as they could, which of course was money, and that Morgan had plenty of. Morgan's plan was to end the hostilities and the competition all along the line. He proposed to Vanderbilt that he sell out his Southern Pennsylvania Railroad to the Pennsylvania Railroad at a low price. In return, the Pennsylvania Railroad Group would sell out the blackmailing West Shore Railroad and give it to Vanderbilt. As a final measure, Morgan invited the quarreling railroad barons on an afternoon in July of 1885 to come on board his yacht, which was appropriately named the Corsair. And there they would wheel and deal and wheel and deal, and a peace would come out. So we'll be looking for that next week. Now, the sources for this, The Robber Barons by Matthew Josephson, America in the Gilded Age by Cashman, Age of Moguls, The Story of Robber Barons and Tycoons by Holbrook. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs. If you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us, either with a donation, a one-time donation, or sign up for $1 or $2 a subscription per month. Thank you very much.